Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:09. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 16th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, I think this is a particularly important time to be thinking about the medium to long term for the very simple reason that both the Fed and the Bank of Japan are meeting on the 21st, and it is going to be a pivotal point in markets. And if we actually look at what's been happening over the last few weeks, then we can see that markets have been, to a certain extent, insuring themselves against the potential for a rate hike. So, for example, precious metal prices have pulled back pretty sharply this week, and today was no exception. And platinum in particular was down 15 at the close, and getting all the way back down to test that $1,000 round area. Gold is back to almost $1,300, and silver was also down as well. It's back below $19. The exception, of course, is palladium, which was up 18. And that has been a fairly tight consolidation in the region of a previous peak there for palladium. In the bond markets, what we've seen is a move in yields over the last 2 months, from July really, where yields on the 12-month yield, which is perhaps, you know, where one of the areas that we would expect to see people hedging their exposure to interest rates. And what we've seen is that that yield has gone right up to test the progression of lower rally highs within what is a more than year-long range. But how much higher is it likely to go when we have a Fed meeting on Wednesday? Then it's a very similar story at the longer end of the curve. When you look at the 10-year, there has been a process of mean reversion going on in terms of those yields, and they've got right up now today to test the region of the trend mean and pulled back from that mean as well by the close. So it's unlikely that we're going to see yields getting very much higher from here, at least until after we get whatever the decision is likely to be from the Fed. When we look at Japan, then the yen has been reasonably steady at 102, but has not strengthened beyond 100. And what the Bank of Japan decides to announce on Wednesday is likely to have a rather large impact on what exactly does happen with the yen. The Nikkei is currently holding here at 16,500, so that had also experienced a mean reversion and has failed so far to get above the 17,000 level. And I don't think that there's anything beyond the regular playbook here that people have been employing with Japan to consider that we would need to see some yen weakness in order to see some Nikkei strength. In Europe, today the fine handed down to Deutsche Bank is outsized by any measure. They were expecting something in the order of 3 billion, and it has been 14 billion. And I personally see that there is a very sharp coincidence between the size of the fine handed down to Apple and that handed down to Deutsche Bank. So what we're seeing is punitive trading of fines against one another's companies. And you know, this is hardly something that will build international confidence. But when we look at Europe, then the banking sector has pulled back. That has resulted in the majority of European indices in negative territory today, and both Spain and Italy, and indeed the DAX, down in excess of 1%. Actually, Italy was down almost 2.5%. And by and large, what that has resulted in is in the majority of European indices, at least in the Eurozone, encountering resistance in the region of their respective trend means. Whereas the DAX was trading just above it, then it really does need to find support now in the region of the MA if we're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And what happens in terms of the euro is going to be a very big deal for what happens, generally speaking, within the Eurozone. And the euro is around 111.55. The dollar was quite firm in here today, and particularly against the euro and the pound. The pound is now down to 130, so it has really collapsed from 135, and there is basically speculation about when Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty is going to be activated, and a number of senior politicians in the Eurozone have said that Theresa May has said to them that it is going to be early next year. And that introduces a certain amount of uncertainty, and markets just a poor uncertainty. So the pound remains weak, and of course that does help to bolster UK competitiveness. However, what it also does is it raises big questions both for the UK and the Eurozone, and there are a lot of competing priorities going into those negotiations, and the upshot is likely to be that the UK will be able to survive perfectly well, and but there is the possibility that what it is going to stoke is additional pressure, additional questions about what is the medium to long-term ambition of the European project. And because we have these big problems, and because we have politicians that don't appear able to break out of the status quo that has been in evidence for decades, then that is creating a great deal of voter discontent. And I had dinner with a number of subscribers during the week, and the topic of the presidential election in the US came up, and there were some very passionate views held, but a general dismay at the rise of populism. Now, that's, we can say that we do have evidence of a rise of populism in the US, in the UK, in France, Germany, Hungary, Italy, and then if we look further afield, it's certainly in Eastern Europe as well. And definitely we had that in Greece, although they have certainly been brought to heel there. And populism doesn't simply rise on its own. It is rather a symptom of a broader malaise within the political establishment. It is a symptom of disaffection with their lot among people that view themselves as disenfranchised by whatever the economic system is. So, and we can, if we look around, we can find ample evidence of that. In fact, the Occupy Wall Street, the and such events, and what we could also view as one of the unrest and the Arab Spring that we've witnessed over the last number of years in the Middle East is symptomatic of a similar set of conditions, although the outcome has been somewhat different. What does that mean in terms of the environment overall? Well, one way to think about it is that the Fed will raise rates because they want to get ahead of the curve. They want to be able to say that they were doing what was required. That I think would be cavalier. That would be something that would be really quite distinctly out of character by the extreme caution that central bankers have tended to display over the last few years, or at least ever. Then there is more the potential that they will be very cautious, because to do anything other than that would be foolhardy, because they don't have the green light, so to speak, in terms of the inflationary figures, and because oil prices have been so volatile, then the likelihood of energy prices contributing to inflationary pressures is going to probably come out of the statistics over the coming quarters. Then, if they don't have inflation, and we saw wage growth coming back, quite sharply the last on the last iteration, then they don't have a burning reason to raise rates. It would be then they were, I suppose, expressing extreme caution that they are worried about a bubble developing. And there is a bubble developing in international bonds. Whether you have a bubble in treasuries is perhaps questionable, or perhaps a better way of saying it is that there is less evidence that the mania has peaked in terms of US treasuries. But when you have negative yields and you have upwards of a third of government bonds internationally trading on a negative yield, then there is evidence of a mania. And one of the defining characteristics of a mania is that the crowd will tolerate contradiction. And the belief that you can make money by paying people to give them your money is risible and an absolute contradiction. So then we have one of the defining characteristics evident of a mania. We have had an extreme move in terms of yields, so there is a certain amount of acceleration. Then we have been in a bull market for 36 years, so this is not a new story. In fact, it's been going on for so long that there is a large degree of complacency in the market. Well, then what the Fed does and how the Fed tackles its debt load is a very important characteristic. And one of the things that I've been looking at is the velocity of money. And there are, of course, two ways to look at it, that the velocity of money is has been declining because we have an economy that is not performing. There is, of course, the other way of thinking about it is that the velocity of money is declining because the number of transactions that on which it depends has been declining, and the reason for that is because of technology and not because of economic malaise. And I think that that rhymes more with empirical evidence and of how people are actually living their lives. Because when you think about shopping for Christmas or the holidays, then the vast majority of people are going to have a look on Amazon before they head off to the shops, if nothing else, than to just simply check the price. Well, if we have the velocity of money declining, it's very difficult to countenance that we're going to have a massive contraction in the supply of money, because that would run contrary to the Fed's founding principles. And if you just read the mandates of what the Fed does, the Fed has to keep enough money in the system to ensure that there is a ample prospect for economic growth. And if the velocity of money is trending lower, then the quantity of money that has to be in the system is going to be larger. And that also means that interest rates are going to be generally lower. The only way that they could really justify raising interest rates is if velocity of money was accelerating. And we haven't had that for, well, the velocity of money peaked in 1997. That's nearly 20 years ago. So then the only way that they would raise rates aggressively would be because of a very benign environment overall. Now, one of the potential outcomes is of a rise in populism is fiscal expansion. And we may get that in the US, and how large it is will depend on not so much on who wins the presidential election, but who has control of the houses. There is the potential that we're going to get that in Japan. It was interesting this week that there were Japanese officials saying that whatever it is that they decide, that negative interest rates are going to be a big part of that. And certainly, negative interest rates appeal on an academic or to a certain academic perspective, but they're inherently deflationary. It is very hard to consider that you're going to have an inflationary outcome if you have negative interest rates. If the Bank of Japan is going to pursue that particular goal, then the likelihood of them persisting with that goal into the medium term, I think, is quite unlikely. And then that would suggest that if they do go ahead and maintain their negative interest rate bias, because it's deflationary, that will put upward pressure on the yen. This is a very pivotal point for the Japanese markets. If we have a rise of populism and there are German elections, Dutch elections, I think there's a French election next year, then there is the potential for an additional rise in populism, and that alone might be part of the reason that the Europeans want to play hardball in terms of the negotiations with the UK, because they want to forestall any rise in populism that could lead to a similar vote within a Eurozone member. Because, for example, if Le Pen were to win in France and decided that she wanted to hold a vote to leave the EU, then considering that France has had referenda that have not passed previously, and if they were to vote to leave the EU, it might well pass in France. And that would create an enormous headache for those that wanted to remain within, because France would throw up borders. And because it has a land border with so many of the Eurozone countries, that could present quite an issue. Then this is a volatile period of time. And when we look at stock markets, the preeminence of Wall Street really does stand out as a measure of the fact that a number of the policies that were implemented in the aftermath of the credit crisis have worked better and been more effective for the US than elsewhere. And that is also because of the homogeneity of its internal markets. What we also have in the US is a technological lead. And it is worth considering what exactly does that mean. Certainly, the US is generating, not only has it got these very large companies, but it seems capable of these types of companies just appearing out of thin air and turning into billion-dollar enterprises and multi-billion-dollar enterprises in very short order. And we're just not seeing that to the same extent really anywhere else. And despite the fact that, for example, in China, there has been, say, the evolution of Didi or Alibaba, then that is, and those are certainly major success stories. But at the same time, these are not highly innovative companies. In fact, generally speaking, what's happening with a number of these Chinese companies is that they look what works elsewhere, and then they just create a Chinese version. Alibaba is a perfect example of that, and Didi is simply just copying Uber. They are successful, but it is not because of innovation in their own right. And that technological innovation is a powerful tailwind for the economy overall, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't come with significant pressures. And I think, one of the And certainly what we're seeing is, in the development of artificial intelligence, of quantum computing and genetic editing, and then if you start to combine all three of those, and certainly that is the trend that research is moving in, then we can anticipate that the technological lead that the US has and is which it so far has been virtually unassailable, then that lead could well stretch out further. Now, that has helped to sustain the outperformance of the Nasdaq. So the Nasdaq went right up to test its peak in here this week, and it was up a little bit again in here today. And then there is a very well-defined progression of higher reaction lows, and that really would be required to question that upward bias overall. But even though technology sector is leading, and not only that it has some of the largest market caps, so it represents a very substantial part of the overall market, but it is also having a very broad effect on economics and how both inflation and deflation are measured. Because when we look at the march of technology, and I follow this company quite closely, which is software, and I talked with their CEO early this year, and what they represent is perhaps one of the most, I think, perhaps breakthrough technologies that we've had, because just every piece of clothing that we wear has been hand stitched, usually by a woman in the third world. And they are already getting orders from major clothing manufacturers in Asia that are intent on automating the entire process within a decade. And that represents a major issue for the classical path to economic development that very poor countries have pursued, because by and large the first industry that goes into a country has been the textile industry. But China doesn't want that to happen. China wants to hold on to the textile industry to the greatest extent possible, so they're automating it. And then that is going to represent an issue, because with the rise of industrial automation, the ability of countries to generate the kind of export revenue that would really help to transform their respective economies is going to be a little bit harder. I guess the other argument is that we're going to have much more local manufacturing, and then that would benefit countries that have got the highest populations, because the economies of scale would be more important. And when you see that, for example, the just the chaos that has resulted from Hanjin Shipping going bankrupt, and the inability of major customers to offload their cargoes, then the argument for manufacturing domestically, but doing so in a fully automated manner, or as close to fully automated as practical, then becomes a question of energy rather than labor. But energy prices are coming down, and oil prices this week fell back from the upper side of their range, and WTI is closing out today around $43. The upper side of that range is closer to 50. What we've seen time and again is that despite jawboning by OPEC and Russia, that what they have the decline in oil prices that they've engineered has not succeeded in knocking out on conventional oil and gas in the US, and certainly it hasn't knocked out Canadian supply either. And part of the reason for that is because at $50, there is a fair amount of that unconventional supply is economic, because and a number of these countries cannot afford to send prices back down to $10, which is where prices were trading at when the bull market started more than a decade ago. The marginal cost of production has gone up, and most particularly it has gone up for the key suppliers of cheap oil. So legacy fields in Saudi Arabia might still be producing at $10 a barrel, but their new supply isn't coming in at anything close to that. And that represents a challenge, because they don't have a monopoly on oil that is economic at $40 a barrel. And if that wasn't enough to contribute to a ranging environment overall, then the rise of electric vehicles. And I think I'll grant you that today they only represent about 1% of the total vehicle stock globally. But they're growing at an exponential rate. And exponential growth rates have a habit of catching up on you. So that, to get from 1% to 2%, if it's growing at 100% a year, and it has been, then it's only 1 year. Well, 2 years is 4%, 3 years is 8%, and 5 years, down the road, even if growth rates moderate because the size of the market is getting larger, you could be over 10% of the global vehicle stock. And that represents a major headwind for oil prices, because we are locked in a range right now, but when you look out further down the line, then the ability of oil prices to rally back up to that $100 area really is a major challenge. And I believe that it was un if we were ever to see those prices get back up to those levels, they would not be sustained because it would unleash waves of additional new supply. Then, if we're going to have low energy prices overall, the argument for local manufacturing becomes much more compelling. Then, if you have instant manufacturing and you have automated manufacturing, then the market for design will explode because there are so many people who would love to be designers but lack the tools to accomplish their goals. But the tools are becoming progressively more accessible, and therefore it is going to be intellectual property is going to become a much more important resource, and that also plays better to the more highly developed economies. So when we look overall, then larger population countries are the ones that have the potential to benefit, and that is provided they have good governance. Because without improving standards of governance, they are going to squander the innovation that we're seeing in terms of technology, because it is going to be improving standards of governance, adapt to better business models, to better economic growth models that enhance their domestic markets as well as their export markets. And that then really does mean that in I think it was David said originally that in emerging markets, governance is everything, but really it is very simply that governance is everything. And the rise of populism means that the standards of governance are going to be under considerable pressure to improve because there are threats out there, and these are the sorts of black swan events that could have could create problems further down the line. So the fact that the US is becoming more isolationist is a potential problem because it would create a power vacuum, and into that vacuum Russia is already pushing, and so is China. Then India has got major ambitions as well, and if it sees that China is becoming more aggressive in the South China Sea, then it might be more aggressive in defending itself in the Indian Ocean. When we look at the Middle East and Russia, the decline in oil prices represents an existential threat to the status quo, and we're already seeing that status quo is being upended in some of the countries that have got less oil. Well, then if oil prices remain lower for longer, the subsidies that populations have enjoyed for so many years will also come under pressure, and that will create tension. China is growing at, despite the fact that growth rates have moderated, they're still growing at a very steady clip. And they are investing quite heavily in their military. So then there's the potential that they will not be content to remain within their own borders. And they are already flexing their muscles in the South China Sea. When then we look at Europe, there is the potential that the European Union breaks down, that the and their inability to deliver on improving standards of living for the majority of people within its borders is going to be the primary reason for that. And the rise of populism is an existential threat to the European Union. And if you start stringing all of these competing themes together, then there is the potential for war. And there is no sign of it yet. There is no sign that there is going to be a global conflagration imminently. But then we couldn't be surprised that at some point in the next decade or two that we get a major conflagration between major power blocks. And obviously that would represent a threat. And because other than that specific risk, the bubble in bond markets, and most particularly European bonds and Japanese bonds, I think then followed by treasury bonds, in that order of risk, would represent the biggest threat to what is otherwise a bullish environment overall, and most particularly for the technology sector. But the US is continuing to lead, and it is being driven higher by the march of technology, by the fact that the oil price and energy prices are declining, that the alternatives to fossil fuel are being promoted successfully, that and not only are we getting solar cell efficiency improving, but that battery technology is improving. And on top of that, that the evolution of the electric car is creating I guess efficiencies of scale. Technological innovation has the potential to create massive savings in terms of haulage, but there will of course be the additional challenge of putting quite a considerable number of people out of work. So there are definitely benefits and definitely challenges, but from a company's perspective, then it is likely to be very positive. So we have an environment where governance really is improving, and I think that that is the one of the major takeaways, that yes, there is a rise of populism, but in major population center countries, not least in Indonesia, in India, in Nigeria even, and in China, that governance is improving, and that's obviously coming off a very varying rate basis. I think one could argue that UK governance is improving, and how well alternative strategies are implemented in the aftermath of exiting the EU will be a real testament to whether governance has improved in a measurable way or not. If we have improving governance in major centres where a population is increasing and the ranks of the global middle class are improving, technological innovation, which is fungible across regions, and lower energy prices overall, then those are the building blocks for a secular bull market. And then it really does open up a very big question about interest rates, because if we have a bull market overall that results in economic growth, then interest rates should rise, and that would represent really quite a big problem for all those companies that have been borrowing and governments that have been borrowing hand over fist at extraordinarily low rates. When they come to refinance, it is going to create a mountain of trouble if interest rates are above where they can afford to pay them. If, on the other hand, the deflationary impact of technological innovation and lower energy prices keeps a lid on inflation, and then also creates a problem in terms of larger numbers of unemployed people, then the rationale for raising interest rates will in large part be removed. So we could be in a very loose monetary policy environment for the foreseeable future. And interest rates don't ever get back up towards the, or at least not in the next decade, back above 5%. That is a potential outcome. And then it would be a very different scenario from what we've seen with Japan, because the deflation has been led by technology and not by a failure to reform following a big housing bust. There are really very big questions out there, and this is still an environment where demand is dominant in Europe, sorry, in the USA, and there are big questions about whether demand is dominant in Europe and Japan. And I haven't really talked about emerging markets, but emerging markets have generally come through this period, a corrective phase so far, in pretty robust fashion. And part of the reason for that is because of low interest rates, because investors are looking far and wide for a pickup in yield. And that is certainly offered within the emerging markets, and not least because their currencies have already depreciated so abruptly. And then when we think about what the opportunities are, then certainly we're seeing that the biotechnology sector is looking increasingly promising, that the trend towards legalizing marijuana is improve, or I guess it would be depend on your what your personal proclivities are, but it is certainly increasing. And when we look at how investors are treating individual shares, that they are looking less likely to pay up, but more likely to support positive surprises in terms of earnings and to buy things on dips. Now, with the potential for geopolitical trouble, for with the potential for interest rates to stay low for a long time, that is part of the reason that people have been betting on the precious metals. And precious metals have been within a corrective phase for over 3 months already, and gold has almost completed an unwinding of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So I don't think that this is really quite the time to be getting more bearish, but rather to be increasingly alert to the potential for upper dynamics, which would confirm that demand is returning to dominance following what has been a relatively lengthy corrective phase in what is overall a medium-term bullish environment. And until we were to see some of these sustaining moves below their trend means, then we would have no evidence to countermand that particular conclusion. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.